You've found the Digging Oak Island podcast, a podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride. Thank you guys so much for downloading and listening. If you have been listening to and enjoying our little podcast, please consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Go to patreon.com/diggingoakisland to learn more. If you think this podcast is worth $5 a month to you, then please consider becoming a patron of our show. Go to patreon.com/diggingoakisland. Could sign up. You get exclusive access to a live chat during the U.S. broadcast of each new episode of The Curse of Oak Island. And also, I want to welcome two new patrons this week, Plato and Bill. Thank you guys so much for your support. Really means everything to me. Again, folks, Digging Oak Island is on Patreon, patreon.com/diggingoakisland. Sign up, support the podcast, $5 a month. You can cancel anytime. You prefer not to do the monthly thing? It's all good. I get that. You can send a one-time donation if you would like to. The only place I have where we can do that is on Venmo. Venmo, just use the username at Dave McBride Music. All right. Let's get to the emails and from you guys. And we're going to start off with our friend Alan. Alan hosts the Cross the Line 1524, the Common Man's podcast. Which you'll need to know when you hear this first sentence. So Alan says, "Hey, Dave, long time, no talk to, hope all is well. You're my second favorite podcast." Oh, thank you very much. "Among other things in life, I'm a Freemason. I can neither confirm nor deny where the treasure is actually buried. I'll just leave it at that. The research presented by John Edwards was more than a bit confusing, and that's coming from a Freemason, but more confusing was the fact that the team's resident Freemason was not part of the conversation. You would think at a minimum Charles Barkhouse would have been sitting around the table nodding his approval. Words and phrases can be edited and swapped around, but no Barkhouse in the video makes me scratch my head a bit. Charles practically lives on the island and proudly makes known the fact that he is a Freemason. Just saying. We'll see what the follow-up is to this season. Charles is not involved. Something is amiss. Keep up the great podcast and keep the faith, Alan." Alan, I hope you guys are all doing well, too. You bring up a great point here for sure. Where was Charles, the resident Freemason on Oak Island? But I think when we get right down to it, Alan, does it really matter if he was there or not? I mean, do we really think Charles would have questioned any of what Mr. Edwards was saying there? Or I should say that differently. Do you think even if Charles did question any of this theory that we would have seen it in the final cut of the show? You know what? I don't think so. I mean, as you said, the crackpot session was, quote, more than a bit confusing. And not even with regards to just the Freemason stuff. Just how he was trying to put all these pieces together just didn't make any sense, really, at the end of the day. And Alan, as a Freemason, you are obviously in possession of many, many, many secrets that have been held behind closed doors and passed down over hundreds of years. I would assume starting with the Romans down through the Knights Templar, the Rosicrucians, and now to you, my friend. It goes without saying that you can neither confirm nor deny these secrets. I mean, if every Freemason went about confirming or denying all these conspiracies, we wouldn't have any conspiracies left in the world to discuss, so I appreciate you doing that. But listen, man, as a fellow podcaster, can you at least warn me of any humanoid reptiles I might come in contact with that are on your in your club there? I don't know how I feel about that. All the best, man. Check out his podcast, guys. It's a fun listen for sure. Now, with the Freemason conversation in full bloom here, let's go to the man, our old friend and 32nd degree Freemason himself. Talk about having secrets. Steve, you might even be a reptilian. I'm not really sure. Anyway, Steve is here, and it's along with a bunch of points, so I might interject in this. It's a long one, but Steve writes, "Dave, I wanted to throw a few things out there to educate the listeners. To be clear, I'm not sharing anything that shouldn't or can't be shared. It's all public knowledge. Freemasonry is not a secret society. If it were, no one would know it exists. Rather, it's just an organization that has its secrets, rules, and rights. This is no different from the Elks, the Moose, the Odd Fellows, Rotaries, Lions, college fraternities and sororities, or any other fraternal organization. Modern Freemasonry was founded in 1717 when four independent Masonic lodges in London met to form the first Grand Lodge, the Grand Lodge of England. Previously, they had all met independently at local pubs. So, point one, there was no global Masonic apparatus before 1717. Just a bunch of guys meeting at pubs like the Mug and Anchor, as guys still do today. They were probably drinking more than they were strategizing on where to hide the Ten Commandments and Shakespeare's first folios. It would be a misconception to think that the Templars, whose persecution and disillusion started in 1307, somehow passed knowledge of a treasure in a part of the world that, in theory, no one knew about before 1492. Down to very specific Freemasons 400 years later. All right, I want to stop here because, like I said, Steve's got a lot to say. Listen. I don't know what happened to whatever knowledge or riches the Templars might have had, and they undoubtedly had something. This was an incredibly rich organization. Where did all that money go? But if we want to suggest that it somehow was handed down to only the modern Freemasons, then you're going to have to explain to me how that happened, why they picked the Freemasons, and by whom this knowledge was passed down. Because without that, I have no reason to believe there's anything more connecting the Templars to what was originally essentially a trade organization set up to protect and educate people who wanted to be stonemasons, and then much later evolved into a fraternal organization that no longer involved only people who were in that particular field. The only connection I see is that some early Freemasons, post-1717, took inspiration from the past fraternal societies when creating things like their rules and symbology, one of those inspirations being the Knights Templar. Anyway, all right, Steve continues. Point two. This being true, modern Freemasonry would have been maybe 15 to 20 years old when the Garden Shaft was built, assuming the 1735 date is valid. A tall order for a freshly minted organization to head to Oak Island to bury or look for anything. Point three, guys like the Chapels and FDR may have been wealthy and Freemasons, but that afforded them no secret knowledge. Like you and me, they were fascinated by both the mystery and the possibility of getting rich. They just happened to be Freemasons as well. Again, Charles Barkhouse is both a Freemason and apparently a modern Knights Templar. If there were secret knowledge about the treasure, they would have found it long ago. They've got Charles. Okay, let me stop here again. That leads wonderfully back to the last email, right, Alan? I suppose what Steve is saying here is the workaround in the theory is that there were only a very, very select few who ever had this knowledge throughout the centuries, who those few folks are and the secret, even the other Masons, you know, who knows? Maybe, again, those humanoid reptilian aliens I mentioned before. Anyway, Steve continues. Point four, related and not any sort of comment on their theories, but this also means that 32nd degree Freemasons, Scott Clark and Chris Morford, don't know any more than you and I do about the treasure because of their affiliation to Freemasonry. Also, it has never, that I can remember, been stated on the show, but the chances are probably fair that Charles Barkhouse is also a 32nd degree Freemason. Point number five. I think part of the confusion that arises is because there is a modern Knights Templar associated with Freemasonry, specifically associated with the York Rite of Freemasonry. I can guarantee you that while there are some really great men involved in the modern Templars today, they don't know where the treasure is, though they may own a sword. My own wife's grandfather was a Knight Templar. Point number six. I don't remember the season or corresponding episode of the podcast, but you may remember that a member of the Mi'kmaq tribe wrote into this podcast and categorically stated, and I'm paraphrasing from a years old podcast, the flag which purportedly sports the Templar cross isn't a big deal to us, and by the way, was created like in the 1700s or 1800s. I don't think it has anything to do with the Templars. Sorry for taking liberties there. The interest can surf back through the Diggin' Oak Island archives to find the conversation. Listen, folks, just go back and listen to them all again. It's no big deal. You'll find it. Anyway, point number seven. Prior to the modern habitation of the island in the latter half of the 1700s, it's worth remembering that the island wasn't an island at all. It was a peninsula. This begs the question, why would anyone in Europe, even a wealthy entity like the Templars, brave a long and dangerous voyage to go to a largely unknown part of the world to deposit something of great value onto a random Canadian peninsula? There would have been larger and actual islands located that were easier to protect and fortify These were knights, after all, and whatever happened on the island was probably accomplished over months and years, not days and weeks. And locations with more resources and fewer flooding problems. You guys ready for episode 20's mega flood in the garden shaft? That's just Steve's little way of setting it up for us. We'll get to that in a minute. Anyway, he writes point eight, and these are some good stuff here. The bit about the Royal Arch Ode, and this was from last week's show. The Royal Arch is the administrative structure of the York Rite, previously mentioned, from which there is an affiliation to the modern Knights Templar. So John Edwards is possibly trying to tie his theory to the Freemasons in this way. Point number nine. His statement about something like 137 is the 33rd prime number is also tied to Freemasonry and specifically the Scottish Rite, not the York Rite as above. We've joked, but most any Mason who joins the Scottish Rite and works at it can attain the 32nd degree. However, the 33rd degree is conferred, not earned. That is, a man is sort of awarded the 33rd rather than taking a test to earn it or something. Again, probably editors, but that's probably what he's getting at. Just a perspective, the most outlandish of claims warrant the most exhaustive of proof. I'm not there yet on any of the Templar theories. Hopefully, Corey Amall and Chris Morford will prove me wrong. Have a great weekend and dig on, Steve. Steve, thank you. That's two Freemasons this week writing into the taking a, you know, what I would call a somewhat skeptical approach to last week's War Room session. I think in the end, I was just so flummoxed by not only the information presented to us by the show, but also the nature with which it was edited and chopped up like that. I mean, just looking at what was presented and the giant holes in all of it makes it hard to believe they even had it as part of the show. But I tell you guys, this is all the time. Every person I've ever spoken to who has presented a theory in the War Room, and it's quite a few folks now that I've spoken to, but they all say the same thing. They spent hours upon hours in that session, in that room, presenting information and evidence, and it gets chopped down into like a 4.5 minute spot of television. There just had to be more to it. And I say the same thing about this week's, which we're going to get to. Anyway, Steve, fantastic stuff. Thank you so much. Let's go now to an email from another friend of ours. This is our guy named Rob, who writes, "The late, great Frederick G. Nolan was a successful land surveyor for the wonderful province of Nova Scotia. His company was family operated with his brother and is best known for laying the groundwork for Halifax Airport plus countless startup subdivisions throughout the province. I didn't have the pleasure of meeting or knowing Fred Nolan, but his soft, polite, and professional firm manner was consistent in the few TV interviews that I saw of him. It's in my opinion that if there was any professional reason for Fred to be reprimanded, it was because of something that he felt was pretty darn important to stand up to. Archaeoastronomist Professor Gasparini and Fred Nolan are two similar people that probably would have enjoyed each other's company. Fred was on the cusp of a new recent discipline that combines the simulation of ancient skies and their relationship with archaeological ruins and historical monuments. No surprise that the archaeological establishment has shown resistance to the idea that astronomy was practiced in prehistoric times, but a rereading of the finds and even a new analysis of the temples, cathedrals, monuments, tombs, and even more ancient cities have proved their worth. For instance, a conservative estimate of the age of the Great Pyramid is 4,500 years old, and we didn't think humans knew these measurements until much more recently. Another lucky coincidence? Similarly, significant numbers and proportions occur in the numerous other ancient edifices around the world, such as the Parthenon in Greece, the pyramids of the sun and moon in Teotihuacan, Mexico, and the Chinese pyramids and elsewhere. Somehow, the 4th Dynasty Egyptians had it all figured out. One, the Great Pyramid is a scale model of Earth at a ratio of 1 to 43,200. Two, it also encodes its own latitude and longitude, same number as the speed of light. Three, its base perimeter is equal to half a minute of latitude. And finally, it's aligned to true north within 3/60 of 1 degree, making it, I believe, the most accurately aligned structure on the planet. I really do feel that every legitimate idea or concept should be equally respected and given the opportunity to be debated. It is really the scientific way to do so. I appreciate your weekly dedication to Oak Island story and sharing your ideas and thoughts towards unlocking what is recognized as a universal mystery. Sincerely, Rob. Rob, thank you for this. After reading your email, I'm really happy. I'm really thrilled someone, namely you, decided to write in and defend Fred Nolan and Professor Gasparini, because we've been pretty hard on the both of them in the recent podcasts. And while I do stand by my scrutiny of Fred Nolan and some of the things he did on Oak Island, or claims to have done, I really don't have any reason to scrutinize or put down Professor Gasparini. Like I just finished saying in the last email, everyone presenting their theories on the show simply have to be given some sizable, really big chunk of the benefit of the doubt, considering how little of their work actually makes it to us. And for sure, ancient cultures, I mean, you know, this is something we're learning now every day, but they had way more knowledge of engineering, astronomy, architecture than we modern folks like to give them credit for. Much of that knowledge lost with the fall of the Roman Empire and through the Dark Ages, right? We know that now, and we're kind of learning more about really how brilliant they were. By the way, I don't think that means that aliens helped them build this stuff, like some folks at Prometheus might suggest, but instead, I think that they were much more resourceful and much more knowledgeable than we might have given them credit for. I guess the inference here is, could they then have done this alignment with Nolan's cross? I mean, Rob, anything is possible, right? And wasn't it, what's the Sherlock Holmes quote? Once you've eliminated the obvious, everything else has to be taken into consideration. It's something along those lines, even the most extraordinary things. I'm just not there yet. And I have a lot of reason to doubt Nolan's cross, and I think we're going to get to that in the offseason. I was hoping we'd start to see an examination of Nolan's cross this week. The boulders, we're not getting that right now. Hopefully we get that at some point soon. Anyway, thank you so much, Rob. Great, great email. That's all for the emails today, folks. Don't forget, if you have any questions or comments, send them along to digginoakisland@gmail.com. It is time now to discuss Season 11, Episode 20 of The Curse of Oak Island, called Wet and Wild. Now, since we have sort of made a habit here over the last couple of weeks, starting these podcasts with sort of a critique, my critique of the show, my review of this episode, I'll tell you that I really did like this episode, but I have about half the notes from this one that I usually have from an episode, which leads me to conclude that there wasn't really much new here, but there certainly was some cool stuff. So let's get started. We begin with a war room session regarding an artifact found back on Lot 8 in 2022. Now, if you guys recall this, it was a piece of copper. The folks felt it was folded in on itself, and the guys actually took it to an expert or sent images of it to an expert who was an expert on Mayan culture, because when you look at it, it does have that sort of feel to it, just the visual of it, you know, and thinking that that might be what this was. But the expert then said he didn't think so, but thought maybe one of the possibilities was Viking. So since the Vikings are the theory du jour over the last couple of episodes, it seems the guys pulled this out of the closet and had it cleaned up and unfolded. Cool. That was real nice to do that. But they have not, it appears, had it analyzed again by someone who might confirm its origins. Certainly like somebody who might be an expert on, I don't know, Vikings. Instead, what we have is Laird Niven, who says its metallurgy indicates it's not local metal, and that to him it appears to be some sort of decorative piece, like a part of a fancy plate that might go on to something else, right? And then Doug Kroll, again, not an expert on Vikings, but he steps into the breach and then offers up some ideas as to its possible origin. He shows the team this Icelandic paper and another image of something called an astrolabe, which was some sort of tool to track celestial bodies and was also used in navigation. The astrolabe is dated from the turn of the 14th century, 1291 to 1310, and apparently originates in southern France. Both of these items have a symbol on them that vaguely resembles a symbol, that is on the copper piece that we were here to examine. There are plenty of conclusions drawn about how this thing could be the piece that ties the theoretical connection of the Templars to the Vikings, this kind of thing they've been pushing for a couple of weeks now. But as usual, I have a couple of questions. Doug Kroll points out the astrolabe dates 1291 to 1310, which is before the fall of the Templars. Similarly, so does the Gasparini theory, the star theory, which we've been talking about, saying that the Nolan's Cross aligns up to stars, and that indicates it was built around 1200. That's before the Knights Templar. Now, before the Knights Templar are persecuted and basically thrown out of Europe. So if you're going to say that these things help that theory, the theory that the Templars were here and brought this stuff here, then you're going to need a brand new Templar theory, something totally unheard of before, something that says that they hid their treasure on Oak Island long before their persecution began, because that's not what the theory says. The theory is the Templars had all this stuff which they took out of Jerusalem, and then upon their persecution, a secret group of Templars got the most important stuff onto ships, sailed them to Scotland, and from there to the New World, and hid them. They were only here because they were being arrested and run down by the French king. Why would they move this stuff secretly to North America for any other reason during the time when they weren't being persecuted? You got to answer those questions, or this actual stuff, this astrolabe and this piece that now we're dating to this time and the Gasparini theory is actually working against the Templar theory. Do we understand? Do you understand how I'm going here? Also, what are these symbols? I mean, Doug has nothing here on what they could mean. So how about we get that? Maybe if we know that, we can understand the connection. And finally, it's not possible to better identify or date this copper piece. There isn't an expert who might recognize these symbols as being from a certain place. We were already given the hint that maybe it's Viking. There's not an expert that can look at this. There's no way to date the copper. Because right now, this presentation is really cool. But that's all it is. There's no other information really given here. All right, next we stop over quickly at Lot 5, where we see a lengthy recap on the foundation that's being worked on there, a brief scene with the archaeologist working. Now, during this recap, there is a strange talking head scene with Rick Lagina, where he says that Lot 5 structure is starting to suggest people have been working or living on Oak Island for a very long time. Now, I'm paraphrasing here, but he even says something like before the pre-searcher era. Again, I don't have a direct quote, but that was what he was saying, that we're now, you know, this work on Lot 5 is now indicating that people have been here pre-searcher. And listen, Rick, we love you, man. I mean, but we already know for certain that people have been living and working on the island from before the search of the money pit began. We know that. The whole story that an uninhabited island with lights on it is all nonsense. There were people on this island. There were houses on this island. There were livestock on this island long before 1795. We already know that. So I don't like that way, the way in which they're sort of distracting the viewer here. It's not something that's in question. Anyway, the archaeologists find some blue clay, which leads Jack Begley to get all excited about there also being blue clay in the money pit, according to the original discovery accounts. But let me also add in here that there was blue clay found in the swamp. In fact, there was so much blue clay found in the swamp that an archaeologist who was on scene was led to believe that perhaps that part of the swamp, which I think was the upper part of the swamp, might have actually been used as a blue clay mine, a source of blue clay. You guys remember that? For some reason, we don't discuss that anymore on the show, right? Now, speaking of the swamp, let's go over there. Work on the giant digger is continuing, but not much new gets done in this episode. At least there's not here in this southern corner. We're going to talk a little more about the swamp in the next segment. We do get a look at an old map of the money pit from the 1930s, showing quite clearly a stone path. I don't remember ever seeing this before, but according to the patrons in the live chat, we have seen it. Also, Marilee had a great question when she asked, how could the road be visible in the 1930s and then be buried so deep? Marilee, I have no idea. Maybe you guys listening who remember the map can come up with some idea as to, or not the map, but the image, can remember what that's all about. I've looked it up, can't find it. If so, send them in to us. Next, we have a quick scene at the lab with the blacksmithing expert Carmen Legg, who has come to look at two artifacts found in the swamp earlier this season. The first one he identifies right away as being a backing bolt from an apparatus that holds oxen to a cart, so more evidence of work being done with oxen on the island. He also says this one is French and dates from the early 1600s to no later than 1760. Now, that's a pretty cool find. Now, doesn't say anything to me about treasure, but it does mean that we might be rewriting the history of European settlement on Oak Island. The other piece is possibly a wharf pin, a fastener used to hold together planks on a wharf, although he is less certain of this than he was of the backing bolt. Emma says its chemical makeup suggests it might be Swedish in origin. She's very careful of saying that. So Elizabeth on the Patreon asked, quote, how significant is that to the idea about a wharf on Oak Island? Elizabeth, I think we can conclude with pretty good certainty that there were wharves on Oak Island. It's an island, and it was farmland. And this is to about 1750 or 1760 or so that we know that for sure. It doesn't say, again, you know, it makes tons of sense that one or more wharves would have been built over the years on the island and used for various things, and then fall to disrepair and eventually into the ocean, right? That's how these things work. It doesn't say much to me about treasure, but either way, it is fascinating stuff. Again, I like to see the idea of finding out a little bit more about that early European history of Oak Island. And I would love to get some confirmation here on the origin of this piece. Perhaps someday we will. Okay, this week we had another War Room session with researcher John Edwards. This is the guy we talked about earlier and we talked about last week with the Templars and secret codes passed to the Masons. You'll need to go back and listen to last week's podcast. If you don't know what we're talking about, it's just too much to do again here. In last week's session, however, Edwards said he was going to put some X's on the ground for the guys to start digging to find the Ark of the Covenant, using Nolan's cross and then superimposing this Tree of Life symbol. Now, I will admit, in the recap of last week, In the recap section we saw today about last week's theory session, the narrator calls the Freemasons the quote-unquote descendants of the Knights Templar. So I'm going to admit right off the bat, I'm already cynical as I'm watching this, right? I'm already annoyed before Edwards has even started, because I already know there is someone somewhere trying to mislead us and mislead the viewer, and that bugs me. Anyway, he starts talking about the lengths of certain points of the cross, how they all divide into 72, which would make sense. It's a symmetrical structure, so I guess, you know, they all have to divide into something, and that point, you know, at some point, but I digress. He says 72 is an important Templar number because they had a book of 72 codes to live by. The first thought that came to my mind was, if it was divided into a different number, could we also have found a Templar connection? Like, it's important because it was the year of a certain conquest, or the number of pages in a different book, or maybe the height of a church, or anywhere. There are numbers everywhere. Why would they make this cross based on a completely unrelated text, of which they must have had dozens of texts in their centuries-long existence? Why this one? Okay, that's the way I think of things in this stuff, right? Steve on the live chat wrote, wasn't there already a crackpot session guy who came in and did the 72 feet this way, then 35 feet this way, then 49 feet this way kind of stuff? And exactly right, Steve. You can do that with numbers in all sorts of things, right? And my mind is, you want to relate it to this text, to this code of conduct. Well, why? Why does it relate to that or any other particular thing, right? It doesn't make any sense. Anyway, again, there are numbers anywhere. And I was pretty cynical about all this. Anyway, he shows them the spots to dig. And soon we see Billy, Gary, and Jack Begley searching over in these spots. Now, folks, I have to stop here for a second and just remind us all. I told you last week I'd stop complaining about the excavator, but I'm not going to. This guy in the war room had them all nodding and certain that they were looking for the Ark of the Covenant, that there was three spots here under stones where they would find the Ark of the Covenant. So how seriously can they be taking this claim if they're going to start digging for it with a giant excavator? I mean, it makes no sense. They're not going to find the Ark of the Covenant. They're going to destroy it and find it in pieces. It doesn't seem to be a very serious search, if you ask me, if this is how they're going to do it. So they find a boulder that Billy thinks might have been moved there. Who knows? We need to see much, much more of that. And I'm willing to keep an open mind about it and see where it goes. That last sentence there was really for me to try and be a little less cynical and a little less snarky, right? We're going to keep an open mind, folks. Finally, we finish up over at the Money Pit. The episode begins with Rick and Scott Barlow meeting with the Dumas guys at the Garden Shaft, who tell them they have reached their depth and will begin the horizontal probing project to try and find the tunnel they've been chasing all season. So later in the show, we see this drilling begin, and it was down at 97 feet. And it isn't long before water starts gushing into the shaft. The Dumas guys are forced to evacuate as water is really rushing in. So as they're doing this, Rick takes a sample of the water. It looks disgusting, but he tastes it. And he says it's salty, which has the team then talking about the booby trap flood tunnel system. So Steve B, the other Steve, on the live chat spoke for all of us, I think, when he said, quote, could it be horizontal drilling causing flooding? Who could have seen that coming? Great question, Steve. I mean, this is just another chapter in this incredibly long book of horizontal tunneling turning into almost, you know, disaster and safety issues, right? The other question I have was, wasn't this always going to happen? I mean, put aside the history of flooding in the shaft or flooding in shafts on Oak Island. Didn't they spend much of this season trying to fortify the sides of the shaft against flooding, only to drill a hole into the side? Am I missing something here? Either way, for the Lagina's sake, I really hope this is not how the Garden Shaft project ends. Roger from Dumas calls it a bump in the road. So while this all looks like a catastrophe with the Garden Shaft, hopefully it isn't. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of the Digging Oak Island podcast. Don't forget, you can really help the show out by becoming a patron. If you think this show is worth $5 a month to you, then head over to patreon.com/diggingoakisland to learn more. And if you prefer, you can make a one-time donation to the podcast via Venmo. Just use the username at Dave McBride Music. Also, if you'd like to help out the podcast in another way, then you do so by giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your shows. And a big thanks to everyone who's done that. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Don't forget, you can follow the show on Facebook. Just put at Digging Oak Island into your search bar. And if you have any questions or comments that you want to send directly to me, you can do so via email at diggingoakisland@gmail.com. Just keep in mind, if you do send me an email or a direct message, I'm going to read it here on the podcast unless you tell me not to. So if you don't want your message read aloud, please make a note of that. Well, folks, it's crown time. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Digging Oak Island.